Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke. Profit is good. Historian Eric Abrahamson joins us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City to detail philanthropy's role in economic development and how things are changing in the digital world. Abrahamson is an author and the president of Vantage Point Historical Services. Okay. Eric, I was going through our archives, and it looks like it's been about 6 years since you were on our predecessor, Dakota Midday. So welcome back. Eric, are you there in Rapid City?
I am.
Perfect. Okay. Once again, Eric Abrahamson, president of Vantage Point Historical Services, is our guest. Let's begin, Eric, with a basic question. When in history did we first start talking about and practicing philanthropy?
Well, philanthropy is ancient. It goes all the way back to, the ancient times. Mm-hmm. But really, I think in a lot of ways, people talk about modern philanthropy as a relatively unique product of the American social system, and it really began with the Puritans who came to the United States and had an idea of what they called a model for Christian charity that they thought would actually shape society.
I'm interested to learn more about social economy and how this fits into an upcoming book that you have. When we think of philanthropy, we often think of it as something that's monetary, but again, that's not always the case, is it?
No, and it's really important that we think about it in larger terms. I mean, it is obviously the money that people provide to support lots of good causes in our communities. But it's also the volunteering that people do. And in some ways, some people look at it even more broadly and say that all of those actions that we take that are non-monetized and that are part of our effort to build a stronger community are all extensions of our philanthropy.
Mm-hmm. Are these things that fit into what we call social economy then?
Yeah, and that's part of what I'm going to be looking at in this book as I work on it, is really thinking about transactions that take place in that social economy and how they work like a kind of glue to hold our society together.
Yeah. Robert Putnam has some interesting thoughts within his book, Bowling Alone, as he discusses the decline of social capital. Maybe you could touch on that and add your thoughts. And I would also add the question, are we still in decline?
Yeah, sure. I think, Putnam has made this idea of social capital something that a lot of people are thinking about and a lot of people are studying. His book, Bowling Alone, written 20 years ago, looked at the decline of lots of institutions that we think of and associate with kind of the fabrics of our communities, everything from PTAs to service clubs like Rotary to Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts to volunteering on political campaigns. And his book, Bowling Alone, was pretty amazing because it looked at how all of those various institutions had declined from the 1950s and 60s, when people sort of think of a golden age for social capital in the United States, and really were not strong and a vibrant part of our communities anymore today.
Let me move on to innovation throughout our history and how this plays a role in the process. I find it interesting that you say innovation is one reason for the income inequality that exists today. Could you explain?
Yeah. The economist Joseph Schumpeter kind of articulated this idea a long time ago that the way capitalism works is that, it's fed by inputs of labor and capital and resources and all those kinds of things, and it grows as markets expand, way back 150 years ago, markets expanded across the United States. Now we think of global markets. And the bigger the markets get, the more that entrepreneurs can grow their businesses to serve those bigger markets. And we think of that as driving growth in the economy. But really, the most profound shifts in the economy take place when somebody comes up with an idea to either make something different or do something different. Think of the classic idea of shifting from landline phones and the payphone to the world we now live in, where we're mobile and we have smartphones everywhere. That innovation has played a huge role in creating new wealth in our society.
One of the things I wanted to add, too, when we look at some of the issues that have brought about the decline in social capital, what advice do you have? Is there anything you can share without giving away your forthcoming book?
Yeah, not only without giving it away, but without knowing it yet. Part of what I'm doing is engaging in the research. But okay. One of the things that I'm really interested in is about 50 years ago, a sociologist named Daniel Bell talked about the rise of what he called the post-industrial economy. And to understand that, what he meant, we have to understand that increasingly over the last 100 years, the jobs in our community have shifted from what people call the primary sector, which is farming and timber and mining, to industrial, which is, we can think of factories. But the overwhelming number of jobs now are what in the sector that economists call the tertiary sector. And really what that means is anybody who's involved in a service job or what we think of today as information and knowledge management. And one of the things that's happening is that we move more and more into this post-industrial economy. We're taking things that used to be part of our social economy and putting them into the market economy. A great example is just online dating, right? A generation ago, you might have placed an ad in the classifieds that you were looking to, you know, find someone to be your idealized mate, but most people didn't meet people that way. Now, online dating is a huge industry, $2 billion. And one of the things that's happened is, as we brought these kinds of social transactions into the market, that's my hypothesis and what I'm going to be looking at, that they sort of thin the glue that holds our social economy together, and that impacts the social cohesion that we experience in our society.
When we talk about the book title, Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, and that concept, Bowling Alone, it sounds like it kind of comes down to a concept of just human contact. When we talk about social capital, the human contact we had is kind of eroded. Is that kind of where you're going?
That's part of what I want to explore, you know, and there's a big debate out there as to whether or not, for example, the relationships that we have on social media through Facebook and that kind of thing, whether they contribute to social capital or they, deplete social capital. And I think there's good arguments both directions. But one of the things I think we know is that, or one of the theories that I'm kind of hypothesizing in this book, is that we need transactions that have weight. So in the past, if you helped out your neighbor, there was a sense of obligation that went with that. And that was part of what contributed to the glue that held society together. And a lot of times, more and more, as we move into a digital environment, even where we're interacting with other people, it doesn't necessarily come with that sense of obligation or even civility. And that's part of what I think is contributing to our sense of fragmentation.
Yeah. You've certainly been at the forefront as director of the John T. Vakurovich Foundation and the South Dakota Humanities Council, and your work with the South Dakota Library Board and the Black Hills Area Community Foundation. It's given you a nice base, and philanthropy has been a very big part of your life, hasn't it?
It has, both as a practitioner and also my career is that I'm an economic or institutional historian, and a large part of my work over the last 20 years has been doing history for philanthropies around the United States, including like the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations and the MasterCard Foundation and the J. Paul Getty Trust and a variety of institutions.
And that's through Vantage Point Historical Services, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Where are you within your new book right now, Eric? Are you just kind of beginning this?
Yeah, I'm really beginning, and part of what I'm really hoping to do is stimulate a conversation that will sort of carry the research forward. So I'm beginning the research now, and also kind of doing a series of workshops around the country at different universities to sort of test some of these ideas.
Eric Abrahamson is our guest, again, president of Vantage Point Historical Services, and that's based in Rapid City, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and he is joining us from our Black Hills Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City this afternoon. This sounds like a lot of fun. You're going to be doing some traveling on this. Are there some things that you're maybe looking for that might surprise you in this process? Some things that you're just hopefully learning anew as you go through this?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of them. I'm working on, I'll just give you one little story, for example.
Sure.
I think this is illustrative. You know, I'm working on a piece, part of the book right now, that just looks at, for example, credit scoring. And if we think back to the 1960s, in those days, if you went out to get a loan, You would sit down and meet with your banker, and he would, ask you about your references and ask you about your credit history and your job and all that kind of stuff. But the odds were that he probably knew you in the community as well. Maybe you were members of the Rotary together, or maybe you went to the same church together. And that sort of face-to-face reputation made a big difference in whether or not you got a loan. Now, there are a lot of strengths to that and some weaknesses, too. So if you were a person of color, that might hurt you, for example, if there was prejudice out there. But in the 1950s, this company in California called Fair Isaac started developing an algorithm, basically, to take all this data and figure out who was really creditworthy based on a ton of data. And by the mid-1970s, we got a new system called FICO, which was Fair Isaac Company. And FICO scoring really changed the paradigm for bankers making decisions about loans. Now they could rely on that algorithm, they could rely on that data, and it diminished the need for that face-to-face relationship. So I'm looking forward to kind of talking to bankers in South Dakota about their experience of that transition and kind of how it might have affected their involvement in various clubs and organizations around their communities.
Yeah, that's a good example. Eric Abrahamson has been our guest on In the Moment, president of Vantage Point Historical Services. We're just kind of scratching the surface. Eric, I hope you can come back down the road as this book progresses. Would you join us again, please?
I'd love to.